Hey, everyone. Welcome to episode 14 of the 2QB Experience. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Greg Smith. I am at Greg Sauce on Twitter. My regular co-host is also joining me yet again, Joshua Lake at Lake2QBs. Josh, how you doing, man?
Hey, I'm doing good, Greg. It's good to be here. And it is fun that we're getting real football reports. We got preseason kicking off here soon, so there's all sorts of things to talk about.
It's August. Fantasy has officially landed, and to give you a very special insight on auction fantasy specifically, we brought on a guest, contributor to 2QBs.com, Josh Berger. How you doing, Josh?
Doing well, Greg. Thanks for having me on. I feel like I'm finally actually coming out of a dark sleep when fantasy football is actually really get video. Everything's getting going. It's exciting.
Welcome. We're glad to have you on. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself here before we jump into the fantasy analysis?
Sure. Well, I mean, I've been looking at fantasy football for a number of years now, and basically from the get-go, I was always really drawn to quarterback. I remember my very first draft actually was not two quarterback, and I remember just kind of being weirded out that all these great players I knew, like back then it was, you know, Peyton Manning or Tom Brady, were going so late in drafts. And so whenever I actually bumped in and got kind of discipled by Mr. Joshua Lake himself into 2QB, it just made perfect sense to me. So I've been doing this. My one true love is the auction draft format, though. So it's my favorite thing to talk about.
Yeah, I love auctions as well. I do a super flex auction with, you know, my buddies at home every year. This year we're doing it on the same night as our snake draft, which is going to be a complete shit show, I'm sure. We'll all be just so blacked out by the end of it. Just, I don't know, bleeding from the eyes with fantasy analysis and, you know, bleeding from the gut with beer or whatever else. Let's jump in. Let's talk about some new stuff at 2QBs before we go too deep on the auction. The first piece I want to talk about is a Marcus Mariota profile by Ben Cummins, and he is all in on Mariota at this point. I remember talking to him, through the writing process, and he said that, you know, looking up all these stats, learning more about Mariota only made him more interested in drafting him. Lake, where are you at on Mariota? I have a feeling you're not quite as high as Ben.
No, I'm not quite as high, but I do like Mariota. I think he is one of the interesting quarterbacks in that middle tier. We've talked about how there's so many you can choose from. I probably am slightly lower on him than Ben is or you, but there's plenty of upside there. It's just such an unknown with what that Tennessee team is going to look like.
Berger, what's your take on Mariota?
You know, whenever I'm talking about a young quarterback, I tend to just keep thinking of that phrase, high risk, high reward. So he's one of those guys that I find he really kind of moves in my rankings depending on who I've already drafted, especially if it's a snake draft, which we're not going to talk about too much. But if I've already drafted a guy higher up than him to be my QB1, I'm a little less likely to go for a guy like Mariota because then I want a consistent QB2. So if I already have a solid QB1, I'm going to actually be less likely to get Mariota. However, if he ends up being my QB1 because I really stacked up on different value elsewhere, either an auction or a snake, then I'm going to be much more tempted because I do think Mariota has the high upside. It's just, for me, I'm a little leery.
We've also got a couple profiles on Jameis Winston and Ben Roethlisberger. Those two are from Anthony Amico, and both are awesome. You should check those out. We know that Roethlisberger is going to be ranked higher than Winston everywhere, but which of these two quarterbacks do you feel is more likely to end up on one of your teams, or which one do you think is the better value?
I'm definitely hoping for Roethlisberger, and to me, it's not all that close. Love what Pittsburgh's been continuing to do, and so if I can get him, he's actually one of the quarterbacks I find I will be targeting, probably even above some of the top four guys, just because of his dollar value in auction formats.
Yeah, I don't think that I will end up with either of them too much. For me, I like the top five guys pretty strongly, and then I see a pretty big fall from Breeze to Roethlisberger, and I don't have anything against him. I don't tend to draft quarterbacks in that range, and then Winston either. I've talked about, I had an article come out today with some other names kind of in that range, and so it's not that I dislike either one. I think they both are fine, but there are some other players I like more around their values, or for Roethlisberger, I'll just wait later into the draft or pay less for a quarterback in an auction.
Now, Lake, another piece that's new on the site, and this just came out today, is just kind of a QBs to target article. And I like this because it's very straightforward. You basically lay out the case for some quarterbacks that you are actively targeting based on their price. You don't need to spoil the piece necessarily, but can you tell people a little bit about, you know, how that went and what sort of qualities you're looking for in that sort of a quarterback?
Sure. So this is just quarterbacks that I think I will end up owning in a lot of leagues. So it's just very self-focused. And then I try and pretend like it's advice for the rest of the readers. but it's basically quarterbacks outside the top 10 that I like, because in the top 10, if you're in a snake draft, your draft slot dictates a lot of who you're able to get. Obviously, in an auction that we're going to talk about, it's a lot different. But these are quarterbacks that you have a pretty good shot of going out and getting. And the ones, as far as what I'm targeting, it's kind of what Berger said earlier, looking for upside, and particularly looking for upside where I don't think it's priced in. So I list some quarterbacks that I think are probably being drafted very close to the worst they could do this year, barring injury. And so there's nothing but upside from that price. That's kind of what I'm looking for.
So Berger, if you're looking through that lens that Lake has laid out, who are some quarterbacks that you would be targeting in that way?
You know, I think a lot of the guys I'm going to be targeting are kind of the lower down level. If I can get a deal on one of the top five guys, whether it's Newton, Russell Wilson, whoever it is, I'd love to. But I tend to find a lot of value, especially with the depth that I believe is at the quarterback position in other positions. So I would like to have some guys like Phillip Rivers, even Eli Manning or Marcus Mariota would be fine. The guys that are going to go three times cheaper often than Andrew Luck, Cam Newton, Aaron Rodgers. But those would be kind of those mid-tier guys that I find often have a whole lot of value. Even, honestly, a guy like Joe Flacco, I think I'll end up with on a lot of my teams just because he continues to produce higher than his ADP, and I can get him for garbage bin value.
Yeah, I mean, longtime listeners of the podcast know that I'm a huge late-round quarterback guy, and while I don't love Flacco necessarily, that type of commodity, like someone who is just going to outperform their value is exactly who I'm targeting. I kind of don't care who the player is on an individual basis. The next piece we want to talk about is one of mine. This is something that I came up with called startable QB percentage or SQB percentage. And it's looking back at the same stats that are used on the site's QB cards. It looks at top 10 finishes, top 20 finishes, and bust weeks, and then looks at the percentage of each on a weekly basis for all these different quarterbacks. And what I've done is I've compiled that all together between 2012 and 2015, kind of mushed it all together and applied it to ADP. So you could look at QB1 on average over the past 4 years and say, how often can we expect a QB1 to finish inside the top 10 on a weekly basis? And it looks at individual ADP rankings, but also like tiered rankings as well, like looking at the top five QBs versus the next group of five, so on and so forth. I think it's a really interesting way to look at the QB position and how it's valued in drafts. This definitely applies only to snake, but you can kind of take the concept of quarterback valuation like this and apply it to auction values as well. Maybe we can talk about that a little later if you guys want.
Yeah, sounds great.
Greg, I really enjoyed the article, and I've gone back to it a couple of times already, and I've taken kind of some of my own conclusions from it. But with the research that you actually did yourself and then writing it up, is there anything that already you think you're going to be doing differently in drafts this year because of what you found?
Yes and no. Like the ultimate takeaway for me, and I get into this in the article, is that I've reinforced the notion that I like the late round quarterback strategy, even in a two quarterback or super flex league. One thing I didn't really expect was how drastic the variance drop off was after quarterback 24 or quarterback 25 on average. I tend to believe that the guys that you draft in that, you know, 24 to say 28 range are generally about as reliable as a, you know, someone in the 20 to 25 range. And the statistics that I came up with didn't really back that up. So I think I'm going to focus a little more on trying to make sure I get two quarterbacks within that top 25. Unless I feel really good about a particular player who's being drafted later. And there are a few of those, I mean, that I feel good about now. But, you know, it's still so early in the preseason that, you know, one bad report or one bad preseason performance might turn me around on those types of guys. And, you know, a lot of those guys could just lose their jobs, too. But, yeah, if anything, it's made me want to reprioritize getting two quarterbacks, two starters at least, within the top 25.
Cool. Yeah, no, it's the charts you had, it was pretty striking. Like you said, how much the variance increases and how the uncertainty really kicks in around that 25 mark.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest takeaway for me is that just if you look at the top 20 percentage, and if you're in a 10-team league, that's, you know, a QB1 or a QB2 every week. If you're in a 12-team league, that's, you know, a good QB1 or QB2, right? You're not including those last 21 to 24 spots. but it's close. It's a close enough approximation in my mind. The top 20 percentage is so it's a lot flatter than I think a lot of people realize, you know, from QB1 all the way down to QB25. And that's a pretty striking statistic or chart when you look at it. I was not surprised, but I was very glad that it reinforced what I believed. Anyway, let's stop talking about me. Let's get back to the guest. Berger, we're going to talk all about auctions on this podcast. But before we do, I do want to, you know, note that you do have auction prices, a cheat sheet on the website. You have an auction strategy post that is amazing. We're going to talk, or I'm going to ask you specific questions about that as we go here. But can you tell the folks a little bit about your general auction strategy and what you're really hoping to do as far as 2QB leagues are concerned?
That's a great question. Well, one of the first things I'm trying to do is just simply outsmart the other team by better understanding the way that the value changes with 2QB. So I mentioned at the beginning of my article, Greg, that whenever you add a different position, and particularly when you add a different starting position like quarterback, every single QB's dollar value increases slightly, and the amount of money available to draft each position actually goes down a bit. So here's what I mean. A lot of times people actually try to translate another cheat sheet for auction, whether it's one QB or some other format, to quarterback, and you really can't do that because you're spending so much more on another starter, even if you're kind of taking a scrub as your QB2, that actually what happens is every single position, you need to kind of drop them down about $2 in value because of the extra money you're having to spend for a QB2 and probably at least one backup. So what that means is, for me, what I'm trying to do is basically get to where I'm getting other people to spend their money fairly early or even the same amount they think they should in a 1QB format. So then I can wrap up my draft in kind of the middle rounds, especially this year where in years past we've talked about, you know, was it Aaron Rodgers or Andrew Luck that was best and they were kind of their own tier unto themselves, or so we thought. This year I feel like there's so many guys that are in that QB1 range that I have no problem spending $25, $30 for my QB1 and then getting a QB2 for a little bit less and wiping up on wide receivers or running backs. That's going to be a big part of my strategy this year. And actually, if you look down further in my article, I actually map out an exact value price for each position. I'm wanting to spend $65 on quarterbacks, about $70, $73 on running backs, and then only $50 on wide receivers. And then the rest, the $12 between that, is going to be a combination of probably emphasizing the tight end with a little bit for the defense and kicker.
Lake, do you start with a budget like that as well?
I don't, and it's interesting because Berger and I have been in the same home league where we draft in person now. How long have you been in? Is it 6, 7 years, something like that, you've been in the league, Berger?
I believe 6 years, yeah.
And in those 6 years of auctions, Berger and I have both had good teams pretty consistently, but we approach the auction fairly differently, where I have kind of a looser budget. So I don't go in with specific numbers usually that I'm spending, but like he does, I kind of rank the positions and relative to one another, which ones am I wanting to spend on, things like that. But I don't typically do exact number values. He and I would tend to agree, I think, that you're not tied to it, like you said in the piece. You look for values, you're willing to change and be flexible. So I think at the end of the day, we probably have similar approaches. But no, I don't go in with specific numbers in my head usually.
Yeah, my approach is pretty similar to yours, Lake. I will try to think about which positions I want to spend the most on or the least on, but not necessarily apply a specific number to those. And a lot of that has to do with just maintaining some flexibility through the draft. And Berger, you talk about that in your piece. And one of the key ways you outline that is with what you call budget breakers and how you plan for those. The example you use is Rob Gronkowski, and it's a great one. So I'm just going to cherry pick this right from the article. If you know that you're going to draft a guy like Rob Gronkowski, or even if you don't plan to, but if you end up with him, which is possible, like you say, you're only going to allocate $10 for your tight end. But if you get caught price enforcing on Gronkowski when he's only going for, say, let's say $15 for some reason, and everybody's just off Gronk for some reason, I don't think that's actually going to happen. But let's say it does. At that point, you've spent more than you originally budgeted on the position. You have to be able to account for that and you know, shift your strategy a little bit to make up for that extra value you spent at the position. Correct.
Right. Well, and that's one of the reasons why I suggest in the article, and actually I do this pretty regularly and Lake can attest to it, I tend to throw out certain key players that I nominate that I think are those kind of bargain busters. So, like you said, Gronkowski is probably the classic. He's been that way for years. I'm going to want to throw him out there, and I have no problem spending up to $42 on him. So if I end up with him, obviously I'm going to need to make some drastic changes. That's one of the reasons, too, why this year I'm tentatively budgeting about 65 for quarterbacks and a little bit more for running backs at 73, because those are two places I feel like I can get some great values if I don't end up with a guy like Gronkowski, who I'm not particularly targeting, but I know exactly where my money is coming from, and it's me dropping my QB budget and my running back budget about $15 each. So I kind of have that plan B in the back of my mind just in case I do end up with a guy like Gronk.
Berger, that raises a question for me that was kind of lingering while you were talking earlier. With a lot of this, it sounds very – like it sounds like Excel. Like if this, then this. You got formulas and everything. What's your take on going into an auction with a very detailed spreadsheet? Like there are plenty – we've seen plenty of examples of people that have these incredible spreadsheets with tons of analysis and automated formulas and stuff like that versus – people that go in with kind of a handwritten budget and a few notes and things like that. Do you feel like one is better than the other, or what's your stance on that?
For me, if I were to take an Excel spreadsheet in personally, because I'm tend to kind of break rules, I tend to kind of push budgets as much as I can, and I tend to really try to read the people in the room, it would be a hindrance to do the Excel spreadsheet. And here's why. I'm very literal, but I also like to try to see kind of what the feeling in the room is. And so an Excel spreadsheet, I can't type that in. At least I haven't figured out a way. And so what I like to do is kind of have a general budget that has, like you said, fairly rigid numbers. But like, as you know, me having drafted for years past, there's been plenty of times where I've completely thrown my budget out the window when I ended up with a guy that I really wanted and then just kind of fly by the seat of my pants from there. I know plenty of guys that are able to take the emotion out of it with Excel spreadsheets, but there's just been so many times where I've been sitting there in the draft room and you see crazy values go for quarterbacks. Or I think last year in our draft, like it was the running backs that just seemed to go, or no, it was the wide receivers that seemed to go sky high. And there was almost no way to really account for that. Basically, then I just sat back and I ended up with a fairly decent draft in the end, just knowing I needed to be patient. Maybe that's me just doing my own Excel spreadsheet in my head, but I like the little more flexibility myself.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I like to kind of think less about my auction values as rigid numbers and more kind of an average case for where I think a player should go. And that doesn't necessarily mean that I won't, like, I definitely want to spend less than that value, but I'm not afraid to spend more than that value either, especially because I do trust my own drafting ability and my patience enough to think that, okay, if I overspend on players X, Y, and Z, towards the end of the draft, when I can exercise a little bit more patience, I'll be able to scoop up some values after everybody else runs out of money. Do you guys take a similar approach?
Overall, I tend to, particularly whenever I've been studying this for so long and I've just for years seen these kind of bargain values that are going for $5 or less, I'm a little bit more likely to go for one or two guys that I really like, even if it's spending another dollar or two. I don't tend to spend much more than that, Greg. And the reason is because the way I make my sheet is you'll notice it doesn't add up to, what, $2,000 if there were 10 players in the draft. It's a little bit more than that, and that's because those are, for the most part, pretty close to a max auction value I'm willing to spend. And that also means that there are certain guys I know, based on my sheet, I'm very unlikely to end up with, like a Cam Newton, because my values tend to be a little lower than a lot of other people's.
I think that's a really good point that's not drawn out a lot with auction cheat sheets, whether you pull them from ESPN, from our site, 2QBs, or wherever it may be, because I think those are two very different ways of viewing it. Is this the maximum? Do not go over this. Or is it a target where you say, okay, if he's $3 more than that, I'll go there. If it's $5 more, I'll go there. And a lot of people that create these, so the writers just don't say. And I feel like those are two very different sorts of cheat sheets.
Yep.
I think you have to make it more of a target because, like Berger was talking about earlier, as soon as some picks are made during the actual auction itself, you can throw all your values out the window. I mean, or a lot of your values out the window. If a price point gets set on a certain player right at the beginning, like Cam Newton going for, say, you know, $35, then at that point, you kind of have to expect that, you know, the other top tier quarterbacks are going to go around there. And if they don't, then whoever got Cam Newton, I'm thinking about you, Lake, in our, you know, mock auction that happened this past weekend, where you stole him right out of the gate. But like, if that price point gets set, that gives you a reference. But also, you can see that those, you know, the gap between what he went for and what his target value was, like, you can kind of project that extra dollar amount, or, you know, extra dollar deficit into the rest of your rankings. That means that, like, some players are going to go up in value, others are going to go down. And the more players get picked, the more that kind of shakes out, which is why I'd rather have an auction value that is a target. This is what I probably want to pay, but depending upon what happens, I have to be willing to go higher if necessary.
Yeah, and I tend to be a little bit more flexible, especially with the high-end guys, Greg. You know, the guys that when you're spending $40, $50 on a guy, is 51 really that much more of a difference? As we get lower down, and this tends to be a little bit more art than science, if I'm down to guys that are like $10, I'm a little less likely to spend 11 on them unless for whatever reason my roster just needs, you know, that guy because the tier drops off or whatever it is. So it's a little bit more flexible. It can get you in trouble, but I find overall I ended up with better teams and better starting players, especially for week one.
Yeah, I really liked your point in the article about nominating kickers and defenses for a dollar. And just the phrase that stuck with me is, if someone outbids you, they've paid twice as much as they should for a kicker.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty significant thing when you're talking about a 100% raise to bid on from a $1 to a $2 versus the 50 to 51 being such a small percentage increase, that there really is a big difference between those two types of raise or re-raise, if you're using poker terms.
Yeah. Well, it's funny how, especially early on in the draft, a dollar feels like 1/200th of what you have. And then in the last bit of the draft, it feels like half of what you have. And so the more you can get other people, whenever they feel like they just came home from the bank, you know, after payday, to just kind of splurge and go after their guys, the better you're able to actually kind of have the last laugh afterwards.
Well, and that's why I do like that strategy of throwing out kickers and defenses if your league has those positions, but not necessarily right out of the gate. I do want to nominate high-priced players, guys who are going to shrink the budgets of my opponents. But let's talk a little bit more specifically about the nomination process.
Sure.
Who are you guys nominating early? We mentioned Gronk earlier. I think that's a great call, especially for a guy like me who doesn't like to spend on tight end. Lake, what is your early auction nomination strategy?
It's kind of shifted over the years, and well, I won't talk about old theories because they may be some that you guys are going to mention. But what I tend to do now is early on take the approach that I don't want to nominate someone I wouldn't be willing to roster. And because I tend to, on my early nominations, in leagues that allow it, I tend to nominate them at a higher price. So not just a $1 nomination for Aaron Rodgers. Instead, I'll start it at 20 or 30, 35, just something to make sure the tone is set, that this is a significant bid. We're not going to waste our time for 3 minutes, just $1 bids. And so with that, I want to make sure it's a player I could own, because if I immediately hit the high bid, which would be bad because then I'm outbidding everyone else right out the gate. But if I do, I want to make sure that it's someone that I'm willing to roster.
That's a great point. And this is just like a courtesy thing, but God, I hate when people just nominate everyone for a dollar. And then what's even worse are the knuckleheads who'd be like, okay, I'll pay two for Aaron Rodgers. Oh, well, I'll pay three. It's like, just get it over with and bump him up to at least like, you know, 25, 30 to start, because we know he's going to go for that much. That stuff drives me crazy in auctions.
Yeah, that's whenever I go for another beer.
Now, how about in terms of, or Berger, I should let you go too. Do you want to expand a little bit more on your early nomination process?
Yeah, in general, I tend to go for those bargain bus there's the guys that are going to completely change my draft first. So Rob Gronkowski would be another one. I would probably want to make sure that I nominate at least one high-end running back, just to make sure, one of the top three, four guys, to see if I can get someone like that. I mentioned in the article that a lot of times the best bargain I get is if I'm the lucky guy to go first or second in the draft while that kind of line is being set or drawn in the sand for who's going to be the most valuable. A lot of times I get the best value and I'll be able to get a guy like Adrian Peterson or Le'Veon Bell for $6 below their actual value, which, if you think about that, $6 is pretty great, especially later on in the draft when, you know, all of a sudden everyone's penny pinching. So I tend to draft relatively higher guys just to see where the values are, and then I usually wait for a while. So it'll be about the third nomination or the fourth where all of a sudden I'm doing a defense kicker, little pesky things like that, because I'm still trying to figure out where I'm going to pounce. My overall theory is I'm hoping to get basically two studs for sure in a draft, and then the rest of them I can kind of flex from there. If I can end up with those two guys that are going to be probably the top four or five, maybe even top three of their position, then I'm feeling pretty good that I'll be able to flex from there and create quite a good team around them, obviously at the right price, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty standard kind of stars and scrubs approach, and I think that that's generally the correct way to do an auction, because those stud players do have, they do have that much more value on a game-to-game basis, that if you can lock up enough of those guys, I mean, we hear about this all the time in snake drafts where, you know, maybe in the fifth or sixth round, you kind of don't like to pick anyone in that range because either there's too much risk with all the guys available or not enough talent or both, some combination of that. And you can see that play out in auctions as well, where you don't necessarily want to load up on balance of like fifth, fourth, sixth round talents. You want to make sure you get those elite guys and then try to find values, guys who you can count on to outperform the price you pay later in the draft. You brought up an interesting point, Berger, about just kind of how aggressive you are in the early rounds, how you like to be one of the first people to get a player on their roster. I want to talk a little bit about just aggression versus patience. We hear all the time that you should be patient in an auction, and I do agree that there's a lot of truth to that. My thing is that I always want to be involved in the bidding. I always want to make sure that if I see something that feels like a deal, I put a bid in, even early on, because those players, if you get them at a value, like that only helps you later in the draft. And there is a reward to being aggressive if your aggression leads to you getting bargains. Like, what do you think about this? How patient are you in your auctions?
I am far too aggressive in most of them. It'll jump in the bidding pretty early and jump the bids up pretty high, like I was saying. So I need to learn some patience with it. I liked the point that Berger made in his article, that there used to be the kind of the standard saying was just don't bid early, just sit it out, wait, and then eventually you'll get good values. I don't know that that, like Berger said, I don't know that that's true now. And so I tend to be aggressive early on and making sure I'm involved, even if I'm not winning a high percentage of the auctions. Just part of it is just personally, it keeps me mentally alert. I'm paying attention to the values. I don't zone out. I don't start talking to somebody else. I don't look at something else on the internet. Like, I'm making sure I'm keeping up with where are the bids, what's going on, what do the prices look like, and just kind of staying engaged that way.
Sure. I find usually I'm pretty aggressive for about the first three or four nominations when that line is being set. And then after that, I do tend to back off for a while. I like to be one of the guys that's kind of the top four by about halfway through the draft, the top four, or even the top two with money still in my pocket. And so about halfway through, however many spots you're drafting, however many players or team owners there are, I want to make sure that I've still got one or two great guys on my team, but that I'm doing pretty well in the money. And so a lot of times, stars, I'm actually trying to get one for a deal and see if I can get it for kind of 1.5 the star value instead of two stars. For that's one of the reasons why I throw those guys out so early. So like one year I got Jamal Charles, who's ended up having a fantastic year for so much less, and that worked really well for me. But for me, I find it's kind of hit really early for those first four rounds, then stop for what typically is about 25-30 minutes, only bouncing back in and you somewhere, and then starting to kind of heat up as we go through about a third of the way through the draft to towards the end. And that's worked really well, or two, of course, embarrassing exceptions.
Yeah, that is pretty similar to my approach. I like to avoid bidding, you know, on the first few players nominated, but I'm like you guys. I like to be involved right from the get-go. And at least, like, if I see a player who appears to be a value relative to my pre-draft rankings, I'm going to bid on that guy if he's the first or second player nominated. But I don't necessarily like to buy right out of the gate. Like you, Berger, I like to be, you know, probably not the big stack in the table, not the person with the most money. But I like to have like maybe the third most or the fourth most almost all the time through the first half of the draft. And then after that, you can kind of expect the guys who are saving their money to be targeting specific players. And I'll try to figure out who those players are by looking at their rosters and what their positional needs are and say, OK, you know, Lake, tends to like Phillip Rivers, and Phillip Rivers is still available. He's saving his money. I'll throw Phil Rivers out there. And that's part of where knowing your league becomes so important is if you understand what certain players that you battle against are trying to do on a yearly basis or like to do on a yearly basis, you can exploit that in the auction for sure. Are there any other little tricks of the trade you guys use?
I think that one of the things I like to do is just, Berger alluded to it earlier, keep an eye on just the emotions that are going around the room, see if somebody just barely lost out on a player, because it likely means that they're going to react after that. And so seeing which way it takes them, if they get quiet and stop bidding, or if they really jump back in on another player from the same position, look at things like, is it getting quiet? Are people getting distracted? Maybe then I'll nominate a player that I really do like and see if they slip through the room. And obviously all of this is specific to live in-person drafts. It doesn't work if you're just logged into ESPN's online system or something like that. But tending to get a read for the room and feel out if there's any way to exploit that, or just get under people's skin a little bit, bid them up when you maybe don't have to, just keep raising the price on someone you know they like, just ways of kind of playing that interpersonal part of the game.
Yeah, that's really one of the best parts of the auction draft is when you're there with the people, you know them, whether it's on Skype or in person, you're just able to kind of razz them a little bit, mess with their heads, and more importantly, mess with their budgets. It's a blast. As far as other strategies that I tend to do, Greg, I find it's really helpful whenever I'm able to get those guys that are about kind of the edge of whatever bracket it is. So I like to get wide receivers in about the wide receiver 15 to 25 range and stack up a little bit, because especially if I can get some of those high upside guys, maybe it's just luck of the draw, but I tend to have a really good amount of luck for those guys to really be able to pounce into that QB or wide receiver two, excuse me, or wide receiver one range. And so I like to get the depth there, and that a lot of times pays off, especially if I've been able to nominate guys at other positions. I tend to nominate guys too, and this is just a very minor trick, nominate positions that I'm not that interested in at the moment. So I like to nominate running backs a whole lot and then focus on QBs and wide receivers, and then I can come back around to running backs unless I found a deal somewhere along the way. That's just a little trick I do a lot of.
I think that's a great point you make about trying to target guys not necessarily in that top tier, but in that like tier 1A, that 10 to 15 range. And I think it's a lot easier to implement a stars and scrubs approach if you don't concern yourself with getting, you know, three, you know, first round level talents or four top two round talents. If you're thinking about it in terms of a snake draft, I think oftentimes it's easier and better for your budget if you target just the one, you know, solid first round talent. And then you try to load up on those like late second, third round type of values from a snake draft, because if all of the other really high priced guys are getting nominated early enough, that's going to make a lot of people's budgets go away. It's going to open up value from that, you know, third round tier of players. And that's where, like you were talking about, you can find guys who are a little undervalued already and break out possibly into that top tier. Guys like, for me, an example is Demaryius Thomas. Like, he's a player who I think is undervalued in snake drafts. And I mean, he'll correspondingly be undervalued in auctions as well. If I can get him for, say, you know, $25 when Odell Beckham's going for $50, I feel like that's a good value, and that's the type of buy I want to make.
No, that's a great example. I'm kind of disappointed you mentioned it, but yeah, he's one of those guys I'll definitely be looking for quite a bit.
Yeah, so speaking about kind of sneaky tactics, tricks of the trade, this is actually one of our Twitter questions from later. It came from Brian Malone, at Brian Malone FF on Twitter, and he asks, what is your favorite sneaky auction tactic? We've talked about a couple. Do you guys have any other ones that come to mind for you?
I mean, it's one of the oldest in the book, but waiting until the last second to up a bid just because it gets under someone's skin much more than if there's 10 seconds left when you bid. I'm all about throwing people off their game.
I'd like to do that in the other way, where sometimes, like, if somebody waits till the last second, I'll immediately bid the next dollar. You know what I mean? I feel like it's important to be unpredictable and not always bid the same way, not always nominate the same type of player or in the same way. I don't think it pays off to nominate, you know, only guys you don't want. Every once in a while, you should nominate a player that you do want, because that can throw people off the scent. I think that just being unpredictable in general is a very strong tactic. Berger, do you have any other like real sneaky things that you like to do?
nothing too sneaky. I like to figure out which position I'm really hoping to kind of seal up first. And so, like, this year, one of the things I'm going to be trying to do is really seal up the running back position. And so, I mean, I'll be nominating a lot of quarterbacks and wide receivers early just to try to get some money out of the system and to see who's going to be the guy that's going to be kind of the poorest man at the table. That's something I keep a really sharp eye on, and I like to actually have off to the side at least an estimate of what each of the other opponents is spending, so then I can better target whenever I do end up in those kind of head-to-head matchups. For example, one of the guys in our league that Lake and I are in together in a couple weeks, he tends to be fairly reckless, and so he's sometimes hard to predict. But what I love to do is I know if I get into a match with him, he'll go up about $2 to $3 on almost any position just to be able to prove to me that he got the guy he wanted. And so that's probably one of my favorite hobbies is just getting this guy to go up. And I think Lake knows who it is.
There's always one in the room.
Always.
So we got another Twitter question here. You might as well get to it now. This one's from Josh Hornsby at Fantasy ADHD. And he says, compare tier pricing versus ADP pricing when projecting player cost. Blake, what do you think about this? I guess it's not really a question. It's more of a command. Do it.
The ADP pricing, I mean, my experience is it really depends here whether you're doing a live draft or a computer draft. I guess I should say an in-person draft or a computer one. Because if you're on some major website, they're going to pre-rank, even in an auction, they're going to pre-rank the players. And so ADP matters a lot more there because the baseline that people are looking at when they're deciding who to nominate and how much to pay is the just what that site considers normal, whether that's ADP or rankings. But if you do it in person, I haven't found that there's the correlation is a lot more loose. Where people are just kind of paying whatever they want to pay, and they're not thinking about ADP, and they're not doing this ongoing calculus of, well, the guy two spots lower went $2 lower, so I should do this. Like, there's not that comparison when you're in person. And so ADP pricing really isn't the most effective thing for me when I'm in person. You have to be much more flexible there.
I agree with Lake that the flexibility doesn't tend to be there as much. One of the things I found is I started off initially doing ADP myself, and I kept going back to tier pricing just because it helped me better understand really where the values are at. Because what you're trying to do basically is you are trying to evaluate in a very obscure game that is so much fun, how good is a player like Aaron Rodgers versus a guy like Matt Ryan or Andy Dalton. And so we're putting dollar values on it, which is about as literal as it can get. But what it can sometimes be is it's easy to almost get too caught up into different values and be like, oh, well, this guy's a whole tier later. So I've actually backed off a little bit and I try to be a little bit more flexible, kind of blend the two together. Because what I found was whenever I started to get too into tier pricing my own cheat sheets, I would add too much money in if I thought, okay, Drew Brees is on the end of my first tier. I got to have him. And then, like we talked about earlier in the podcast, I would spend $4 or $5 more dollars than I really should have on the guy. And then it kind of bit me later.
Yeah, I think the concept of tiers is super critical when you're talking about auctions. You have to understand which players are generally worth about the same or what you expect to perform about the same during the season. Whereas, like, you might like one guy more within that tier and have him ranked higher. I think that you have to be willing to let that player go if they're, you know, being bid up too much, and take the guy that you don't like as much, but, you know, is in the same tier generally. Like, maybe you don't like the difference in how they produce their points, but you kind of have to throw that out the window, especially early on in an auction, and just care strictly about, you know, the value you're getting relative to the price you pay. But with that said, I think there is value to ADP pricing because, you know, if you understand that Antonio Brown is generally considered to be a better player or a more valuable fantasy player than Odell Beckham, even though they're in the same, you know, top tier of wide receivers, you can exploit that in the auction. You can throw out ODB first, try to get him for, you know, a little bit less than maybe market value, because you expect everyone else to maybe think, oh, well, I like ODB, but Antonio Brown is better and he's still available, so I'm not going to bid on ODB. It's kind of a bad example with a top tier like that, like the upper echelon of a certain position, but that comes into play a lot more in the middle tiers, I feel like, where if you are talking about, you know, Matt Ryan versus Jameis Winston versus Matthew Stafford, if you can understand what, you know, the fantasy community at large or what your league or which one of those players your league values the highest, you can try to get a bargain on one of the other guys and hope that the rest of your league saves their money for the guy they perceive to be better, even though your tiers tell you that they're not necessarily. What do you guys think of that? It's a long rant.
Amen.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think that kind of summing up what we many of us have said is that you've got to have flexibility built in, but kind of pre-strategizing about how you're going to be flexible and which ways you're willing to flex and how you're going to decide to do that. All of those sorts of meta level decisions and that strategy is super vital going in, whereas it sounds like we've all said go in with ideas on specific pricing, but don't be so tied to it that you really hamstring yourself. But I think, Greg, your suggestions are all very good ways for how to be flexible and what that looks like.
Well, thank you. yeah. Let's wrap up the general auction discussion with a little bit of like late game strategy. What are you guys trying to do at the end? Have you already spent all your money? Are you only nominating dollar players that you hope no one, you know, bids up to two? Did you save your money? Like, what is your approach in terms of nominating towards the end when the budgets are tighter and the players aren't quite as good?
I mean, that's a hard question to answer because so much will have depended on how I did once I was kind of ramping up the heat about a third of the way of the draft through the way. If I ended up with a lot of great players and my roster is fairly full, then obviously you're kind of stuck and you don't really have any choice in it. You're going to be drafting $1, $2 guys. Typically, Greg, what I try to do is still end up where I'm about halfway through as far as my budget being gone compared to other guys. So I'm hopefully not player 4 or 5 as far as how much money I have left, because I don't want to be that guy that has the most money left. I find those guys almost for sure end up spending too much because there's always someone willing to kind of ramp up the price a little bit on them and just kind of bleed them dry on players that aren't even all that great, like a Michael Thomas or a Ted Ginn Jr. No offense to those guys.
Yeah, I agree completely with Berger that it does depend on what you do earlier. I, in an ideal world, would have just $2 left for every one of my bench spots. I like spending on the starters and not spending much on my bench positions because I trust I can play the waiver wire pretty well and find good players. And so the $2 is just so that I can outbid someone else that nominates a $1 player, because if you are stuck with just $1 bids for your entire bench, you are really limited because only 1 in 10 nominations or 1 in 12 nominations can you get someone. And so you guarantee that you miss out on a whole lot of players that you maybe otherwise would like as a sleeper. So I'd like to be able to outbid some of those $1 bids.
No, that's a good point.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think a lot of it has to do with the size and the depth of your league. Like, if you're in a kind of shallow league, you know that there are going to be values later on in the auction, and you have to plan for that. You have to try to save some of your money for the end, because all those reckless spenders aren't going to be able to finish off their draft with the guys who have been undervalued because people have overspent. And so if you can save up for, like you said, about on average $2 to $4 per player for your last few spots, that can really give you a huge edge in those final rounds when, you know, maybe you do want to bid up a player to 3 or 4, even if you only had them worth 1 or 2 in your rankings, just because you want that guy and no one else at the table can afford to battle you for him. Any other last notes here before we move on to our spotlight QB?
I think one just good reminder in the middle of all these great tips and strategy is relatively stick to your numbers. Don't try to get too creative. If you've made a good sheet, if you've made some good auction values, they will hold true, especially in the middle of all the craziness. It's so easy to get emotionally involved, but time and time again, the guys that for the most part are flexible but not going too extravagant are the ones that at the end of the draft are really feeling great about the roster they selected.
Yeah, that's an awesome point. I think that too often you'll see people go into an auction with that dead set mentality of I want player X or I want player Y, and God, I hate that. It's just, especially if someone can tell, if anyone else in the room understands that you have that mentality, or if two owners in the draft have the same mentality about the same player, which can happen, especially with the elite guys, you're just going to, you know, end up bidding them up to a point where you're really going to hamstring yourself later in the draft. Lake, any final thoughts on general auction strategy?
Yeah, I'll kind of echo what Berger said and just note that in two quarterback leagues, that can often be the feeding frenzy around the quarterback position. So on the podcast, we we generally agree to wait on quarterback. So for auction, that would mean don't spend as heavily. But what we consistently hear from readers and listeners is that home leagues go much, much faster at quarterback, and they value the quarterback much, much more. And so it's really learning to be patient and how to limit yourself and not spending $70 on an elite quarterback just because three other people did, and not spending $40 on a very mediocre middle tier quarterback just because you think you've got to get one and that's what people are paying. And that's really where it can catch you off guard if you're not too familiar with two quarterback leagues, because the quarterbacks can go for very, very high values in certain leagues.
Yeah, and I guess we have been talking a little bit too generally about auctions. Let's talk about two QB auctions a little bit more specifically for just a little bit. You kind of reminded me, like, that this is a two QBs podcast. And I think what you talk about is a great point. And I'll just bring up my own personal strategy with this. And this applies to one quarterback leagues as well. But I completely devalue the position because I'm a late round QB zealot. I know that I'm not going to spend that much at the position, and I kind of don't care which players I end up with as long as they're, you know, generally trustable starters for their teams. And what that does is it allows me to change my auction budget to the point where I can just kind of disregard what I think, you know, the Russell Wilsons, the Cam Newtons of the world are worth, and move that budget to other positions, the positions I really care about, running backs and wide receivers. And if you, you know, can do that, if you can shift your money away from quarterback or away from tight end, if you like to wait at that position as well, you can pump a lot more value into the running back and wide receiver positions. And by doing that, you can afford to overspend on those players. And if the rest of your league isn't hip to that, then you could get a distinct advantage if your late round quarterback targets pan out. Do you guys want to talk a little bit more specifically about two QB auctions? Berger, what do you think?
You know, I tend to be wanting to have one good quarterback whenever I can, so I'm kind of about halfway to where you are, Greg, where you haven't fully converted me on this whole late round thing. I want to have one guy that I know is going to be my starter. I mentioned that one embarrassing time that I had a draft earlier in the podcast, and for me, that was whenever I really spaced out too many dollars towards the bench. And unless you're in one of those weird leagues where you actually do get bench points, your bench players are relatively worthless week to week. You know, you have your starters, and those are the only guys that are going to get you points. So that's one of the reasons why what I ran into was I had tried to balance my team, and I had amazing bench players, but I never knew who to start. Usually for me, I want to know at least one guy at each position that is my for sure starter, pretty much barring any position, any defense they're playing against. And so I like to get one good quarterback, and then if I can flex my money away so I only end up spending maybe $40 on quarterbacks overall, then I can spend a whole lot more on running backs. So that's kind of my general strategy, is get one good guy that's in the top 10 of quarterbacks and then go from there.
Does that line up with what you're trying to do, Lake?
In an auction, I generally am pretty flexible. I tend to try and figure out my other positions first and then see what my budget is left with. Because quarterback is so deep, I feel like I can take a shot on an early guy, or I could wait a very long time. So I'd rather kind of solidify the other positions and let it dictate what I do at quarterback.
I think that's an important distinction to make. And I guess I should clarify a little bit that when I say I'm a late round QB guy, what that really translates to in a snake draft is that I want quarterback value. I want to get guys who are going below, you know, what we should have to pay for them. And I feel like you can apply that to auction with high-priced guys if you want to. Like, if I see that Russell Wilson is only going for $20 or $25 in a 2QB league, but I think he's worth $30, then, you know, I don't mind making that bid and ending up with him if no one else wants him there. Anecdotally, though, I found that, you know, generally the high-priced guys tend to always be high-priced. That's just how it goes. And I end up with more of those mid and lower-tier quarterbacks. But I'm not opposed to drafting those other guys if I feel like the value is right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, for sure. And it's, I think that flexibility is important. And just thinking through, like, Sal's draft strategies articles on our site are a great example of having something big picture like that in mind as your ideal, but then understanding the different approaches. And so being able to flip from a two late round quarterback guys to a studs and streaming approach, or just to have those concepts in your mind so that you know what you're doing even as you're bidding.
Yeah, there's a lot of gray area in between those three, you know, basic archetypes of 2QB drafts, that's for sure. We were talking about you know, elite quarterbacks. And that's going to bring us to our spotlight QB for this episode. And it's Aaron Rodgers. I don't know if I actually mentioned that at the top of the episode. I was so busy remembering to announce that Lake was on the show that I forgot to, I may have forgotten to specify that this is the Aaron Rodgers experience that you're listening to right now. And we're going to start off the spotlight as we do every week with the quarterback finish game. We're going to guess how Rodgers will rank at the end of the season in total points and points per game. Berger, you're the guest, so you have the honor of going first. Let's do total points first. Where do you think he ranks among all QBs at year's end?
I'm a little down on Rodgers this year. I think that he's starting to show some signs based on the offense that this is not going to be Aaron Rodgers' year, which is the reason why he's ranked lower than first or second. That being said, of course, he's a great guy and a great athlete, but I'm going to put him probably finishing around 5, maybe 6 by the end of the season. I think one of those guys in the top 10 is actually going to jump over him, and he's going to disappoint a lot of people just a bit.
Wow.
That's bold. I haven't heard anybody be that low on Rodgers, and I'm generally kind of low on him at QB3. I'm actually going to predict that he finishes as QB4. I think he's a little bit safer than some of the other guys below him, but I agree that there's a good chance that someone leapfrogs him just with a really high-end season. How about you, Josh? Or how about you, Lake?
Thanks for specifying, Greg.
Yeah, I try.
I am much higher than the two of you. I will go QB1 in final finish and QB2 in points per game because I do think there's the possibility that Brady comes back and lights the league on fire, but the missed 4 games hurts him. So I really expect Rodgers to do well. There is some concern still as to what the injury with Jordy Nelson looks like and how serious that is, but I do think that a whole list of issues and struggles the Packers had last year between Lacy and Nelson and Cobb even battling some injuries and just offensive line, I think a lot of it contributed to Aaron Rodgers struggling. I don't believe that he is suddenly a bad quarterback. And so I think that he comes back and that team really starts clicking again. And he has the track record to be the top quarterback, whereas we have questions about everyone in the tier. I feel like he's one of the more certain bets if you're going to be just playing the odds.
Yeah, let's finish up the points per game predictions, because I do want to get to more about what you were just talking about, Lake, about Jordy and the rest of that supporting cast. I'll put Aaron Rodgers in the same place, QB4, in terms of points per game. How about you, Berger?
I would say points per game, I'd probably still put him about QB5.
Okay, fair enough.
So a little lower than y'all.
Yeah, that's good. All right, let's drill down on this injury to Jordy Nelson, or these concerns about Jordy Nelson's health. Like, if I told you that, you know, Jordy Nelson was going to miss half his games this season, let's say a report comes out that he needs surgery, he'll be out till week 8 or whatever, how would that affect your ranking of Rodgers? How far down would you slide him based on a report like that?
If Jordy was gone half the year, I'd probably downgrade Rodgers to 3 or 4. In the rankings, I think he'd still be in that elite tier, but he'd probably be the bottom of it. I think I'd still take him over Drew Brees just because Drew Brees' road splits are real ugly.
They're bad.
Just like Rodgers without Jordy last year. And so that's probably where I'd go. My gut is to say I'd put him 4th, but I haven't put a lot of thought into it.
What do you think about that, Berger?
He would definitely drop. He'd probably be more like around QB 6 or 7 for me. And I think that there would be a good chance that the points per game would decrease quite a bit as well. Part of the reason for that, though, Greg, is I tend to believe that a lot of the fantasy season is already over by week 8. If you haven't really established yourself to be in the top 4 or 5 teams by that point, you're really struggling. And so I like to not necessarily skew my rankings at all, but at least be mindful of the fact that the first 4 games this season are really going to determine a lot about where I stand. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm a little lower on a guy like Aaron Rodgers and even a guy like Tom Brady.
Yeah, I'm not as concerned about Tom Brady, if only because we know the risks going in when we draft him, and he's being discounted in drafts as such.
Right.
But with Rodgers and these like kind of nebulous concerns around Jordy, there's a wider range of outcomes, right? Like Jordy could play and he could be fine, and Rodgers could be amazing and finishes the QB1. Like, that's within the realm of possibility. Yeah, I probably wouldn't bump him down too much more than I have him, because I do think he's very good. Like, he'd slide behind Breeze for me, but I'd still have him ahead of Brady, if only because we know that Rodgers is going to play. Just because Jordy Nelson isn't there doesn't mean that Rodgers can't be good. I mean, they have added experience and other players to that receiving core to help make up for any potential losses to injury. I mean, they have Jeff Janis, a year older, Davante Adams, you know, however you feel about him, he should be better this year than he was last year because he was utter trash in 2015.
He can't be worse.
That's right. Jared Cook is there too. And again, he's another guy who's never proven anything, but just the possibility that maybe he breaks out once he has a good quarterback, like all these things kind of help hedge against the Jordy injury. So I wouldn't be too much further down on Rodgers. Like, I'm already down on him a little bit. Like, part of why I have him ranked as low as I do is baking in the risk around a guy like Jordy Nelson. Like, I already don't trust his knees to stay healthy the whole year. And that's why I have Rodgers where I do. Now, if you exchange Jordy Nelson for Demaryius Thomas or some other generally healthy wide receiver, like, I'd probably have Rodgers ranked as my QB2. I've already baked that risk into my ranking of him at QB3, QB4. Let's talk a little bit specifically about Rodgers in an auction and these high-priced quarterbacks in an auction. How often do you end up with these guys? I've talked about how I like to wait, but do you guys – are you willing to spend top dollar on an elite quarterback?
I tend to hesitate a little bit. I like to get the guys in the top 10, but often that's meant that I don't end up getting one of the guys in the top tier. Part of the reason for that, though, Greg, is because our team is kind of like one of those typical home teams where the league actually drafts quarterbacks so incredibly high that, I mean, I've seen guys like Aaron Rodgers go for $65, even $68 in a 10-team league. And so that's one of the reasons why I feel like in a lot of these auction drafts, it ends up being I get one of the guys that's number 7, 8, or 9 that I'm thrilled about, but he also went for $15, $20 cheaper.
Yeah, I generally don't end up with them. I will, like I did in our mock auction that's going to be written up on the site that we had just this last weekend. I ended up there with some really good quarterbacks because the values were so, I mean, it was incredibly cheap in my view. And so I'm willing to, if I think that there are early nominations that are kind of slipping by people, like Berger has talked about, that early on when people don't know prices, they're a little hesitant. And so if you can early snag one, I'm up for it. But if they are really going as kind of the highest priced players in the league, I generally am also going to wait and take some later options.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I like to see where those elite guys get priced in the first place so I can get a better idea of, you know, where the mid-tier and second-tier guys are going to end up. And in that auction you're talking about, the one we did this past weekend, you're right. The experience was a lot less like a home league and more like an analyst draft where everyone was kind of devaluing the QB position. You ended up with Cam Newton for 33. Russell Wilson and Andrew Luck both went for more. Aaron Rodgers went for a lot more at 45. And of those, like, you definitely got the best value at Newton for sure. After seeing those prices get set, I ended up with Carson Palmer at $24, which felt like it was definitely more than I wanted to pay for my QB1, but like Berger was talking about earlier, like, I'm okay paying that price because I feel good about Palmer. I like that offense. I ended up getting caught price enforcing on a guy I hate, Derek Carr. I paid $10 for him, but in a 2QB league, that sounds like such a deal to me that I kind of don't care that he's not my favorite target, you know? He just felt like a good value. Happened to me later in the draft, even still, with Tom Brady going for 17, and I talked about how you can kind of plan for a guy like Brady missing time. Getting a guy who could produce at a QB5 or a top 5 QB level for the games that he does play, that's worth $17 at an auction to me, even if I know he's going to miss 4 games. So generally, I like to try to let the value come to me. And that, like you said, doesn't typically end up happening with the elite guys, especially in home leagues where, you know, certain drafters are going to get a little overzealous and say, oh, I'll pay anything to get Russell Wilson, or I'll pay anything to get Andrew Luck. Any other thoughts on Rodgers before we kind of wrap this episode up, guys?
I will say that if you want to be convinced that Rodgers is really not good and in for a bad year, Anthony Amico is one of the big names. He writes for us. Most people know him. He's on Twitter at Amicsta, A-M-I-C-S-T-A. But he is very down on him, and I had a tweet the other day comparing Aaron Rodgers without Jordy to Alex Smith and saying their stats did not look that far off. So if you want to be convinced that Rodgers is a risky pick, he's a good person to kind of follow his work.
Well, if you look at our 2QB cards, you can actually see that play out a little bit. Rodgers is great in terms of producing elite weeks, but he tends to have more bad weeks than a lot of the other top-tier QBs. And You know, that rushing upside that Wilson and Newton have definitely helps buoy them away from those bad weeks. But for whatever reason, Rodgers has more weeks where he finishes outside the top 24 at the position. And that's something worth noting. I mean, that it's a consistent trend over the past 4 years.
Overall, I would agree that his inconsistency is part of the reason why he's been a little lower on my rankings and part of the reason why I think I've surprised both of y'all with my hesitancy around him. I like the guy, but I think this year is going to be more of a struggle.
I mean, we'll find out. That's half the fun, right, is the unknown of this stuff.
Well, and even for Aaron Rodgers, half the struggle still means he finishes well inside the top 10.
So yeah,
we're talking kind of very small little changes.
Right, but if he's being drafted as the QB1, then you're overpaying for that value in essence.
I think so, yeah.
Yep. All right, before we go, we have one other Twitter question to get to, and I'm going to tie this into the site. This one comes from Nick Down, at NDOW88. He asks, where can I find a 2QB and Superflex auction league? And one way you might be able to find that, Nick, is if you get onto 2QBs.com, check out our league finder page. It's up in the top menu under resources. You can post that you want to play in an auction league. You can post that you're starting an auction league. Try to hunt down some more players. That's my main recommendation. Otherwise, you know, put it out there on Twitter. You know, try to get some retweets. You can tweet at us. I'll retweet it for you. Help you find some league mates. Because this is the best way to play. Like, auction is... do you guys agree with me that auction is superior to snake draft?
Oh, absolutely. It's not even close.
Yeah, it's by far my favorite. It takes a little longer, but it's totally worth it. And I feel like you actually get the team that you're really hoping for, whereas snake, there's a lot more of just kind of I got some of the guys I liked. I like the do or die nature of auction. It's intoxicating. It really is.
Yeah, that's the best aspect for me as well, is that no matter who you are, you have access to all the players in the league. And I run into this problem in my home Superflex auction because it's a keeper league. Like, it takes away that small bit of auction that says I can get any player I want, because if someone keeps a guy, that means I never get to bid on him. So that's a discussion for another podcast, though. Let's wrap things up here. Berger, I really want to thank you for coming on. We appreciate your time. I know you're very busy, and be sure to check out Berger's articles on 2QBs.com. The auction strategy piece was amazing. The auction values are super helpful. Do you have any tips for readers on, you know, or listeners on how they can maybe tailor those ranks themselves? Like, I talked earlier about maybe devaluing the quarterback position to put more dollars into other positions. Any tips or recommendations on that, like, or maybe pitfalls that people should avoid when trying to assign their own values to players?
Sure. I mean, one of the first tips I would say is make sure that you agree with my overall philosophy just looking at the cheat sheet itself. When you're looking at this sheet, it is kind of my roughly max value that you're going to be going for in each of these guys, and that's really important to note to start off. So if you spend, you know, $51 on Andrew Luck and $50 on Cam Newton and then get Todd Gurley for $59, well, you're pretty quickly without an entire rest of your team. As far as kind of how tailoring it to you, I would say I like to pick kind of a position and then get a rough estimate for what I'm willing to spend on that, because it's important for me to know as I bid on a guy that I really like, hey, I'm losing dollars for getting my tight end or getting my quarterback. So I like to come up with those positional values. Like I said, for mine, I tend to have running backs going in kind of the low 70s, quarterbacks and wide receivers 50 to 60, and then the rest of the money goes to tight ends. And that's super helpful for me to know because I can remember it quickly and I can jump on it, and then I can kind of improv as the feel of the room continues to develop an auction. That would be where I would start, and then you can kind of tailor my rankings from there.
Very cool. So, yeah, be sure to check out that work from Berger on the site. You follow him on Twitter, at Berger2QBs, and that's same as Lake, same as our Twitter handle on the site, TWOQBS, correct?
That's right.
Yep. Follow the site on Twitter, at 2QBs. You can like us on Facebook. Just search us up on there. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or anywhere else you can. You can always send longer form emails to 2QBs@gmail.com. And to wrap things up, I'm going to let Josh Lake tell you a little bit more about our mock drafts that are now running weekly.
Sure. So every Monday we kick off a new round of mock drafts. They're run on My Fantasy League. They're free. We use 8-hour pick timers, so you can do it with a work day, a school day, whatever you've got going on. And you kind of pick as you're able. So most people don't take anywhere near 8 hours to pick, but if you just hit a busy time, you're able to. So,
or should they?
Yes, if you can pick quickly, please do. But What I was going to say is that these are 10-team leagues, half-point PPR. They're just a good way to get kind of some reps and some practice doing 2QB mocks because there aren't a lot of places to do that. So if you're interested, send us a tweet at 2QBs or shoot us an email. Greg already mentioned the email address. And just let us know, and we will get you an invite for one to kick off Monday.
And that was Joshua Lake. You can follow him on Twitter, at Lake2QBs. I'm Greg Smith. You can follow me at Greg Sauce. I want to thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the 2QB Experience. We are out of here.